In the lead up to the federal budget on May 9th, we're looking at three pretty important policy areas that have a very significant impact on our daily lives: housing, jobs, and health. I mean, you'd have to sort of identify those as some of the most important things that certainly affect people every day. Tonight, in the first of three big conversations, we're focusing on housing affordability. And we've been asking for your help over the past few weeks to send us your stories about the housing market. Thank you so much for answering our call. Here's what some of you have had to say.
This is just one option. I realise that it's probably not everybody's cup of tea, intergenerational living.
The pursuit of home ownership is pretty unrealistic for someone in my position.
Look, I think it's fine if people want to spend all of their money travelling for years and living in the centre of the city, but you can't expect to do that and have a deposit.
It's virtually impossible to pay rent at Sydney prices and save for a 10% deposit.
Those goalposts keep on moving further away from us.
This expectation that we have to have this amazing three-bedroom house that's sort of all done up and all the rest of it is just ridiculous.
Taking in a boarder or letting out a room were very usual things to do, especially for older women.
We should spare a thought for those at the other end of the housing spectrum, the people who can't rent because there isn't enough affordable housing.
Yes, some pretty familiar feelings there. Frustrations with a lack of supply, difficulty saving, and the goal of owning a place moving out of reach. But what about policy, politics and economics that underpin this landscape, which will all be in play in the upcoming budget as, of course, so many interests have to be dealt with, of course. Some people have to lose if some people gain. This is the thing. There are always losers, and this is what the government's dealing with. To help us navigate through all of this is Nicole Gurran. She's a professor of urban and regional planning program at the University of Sydney. Fleur Anderson is a political journalist with the Australian Financial Review that has written about housing and these issues. And also Louis Christopher, a property market analyst with SQM Research. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Now, we'll all get to more of those listener voice memos in a moment, but you all come at this problem in pretty different ways. I want to hear from each of you briefly in less than a minute each because, you know, I like to raise the bar. What is at the heart of the housing affordability problem in Australia? I'll start with you, Louis.
Oh, at the heart of it is ultimately about supply not meeting demand, if I'm going to look at it purely economically. Demand has been increasing. There's more and more people in this country, and ultimately we're not meeting the needs of that demand when it comes to housing. Of course, we've made attempts to, but ultimately we still have problems as we speak.
Fleur, the government's grappling with this. We keep hearing it's going to be the centrepiece of the budget. What are the issues at play here?
Well, I suppose essentially the government is dealing with decades of legacy policies that see us investing all of our money in a sort of retirement superannuation vein into our houses, because that's been our main asset. And on top of that, the governments, successive governments, have tried and failed so many times with so many different types of housing policies. There's just not one clear way of dealing with it without really annoying great sections of the community who either already have their houses and don't want to see their house prices go down, or the people who can't get in.
And Nicole, all of these issues are at play, of course, and I mentioned that issue of winners and losers. Of course, when you start trying to find ways of reducing house prices, well, the people who already own the houses aren't very happy about that, and that's one of the issues there. Is it just all about supply, or are there other issues too?
It is about supply to a degree, Patricia, but in my analysis, what has occurred over about a 20-year period is we've seen prices detached from earnings quite dramatically. And what that's meant is the gap between what the private market is able to supply and what lower and increasingly moderate income earners can afford to rent and buy has grown. And at the same time, rather than supporting an affordable non-profit housing sector, that's traditional public housing and that's affordable community-based providers, we've relied very heavily on the market, and so we've lost the capacity to build homes for people to live in rather than simply to build homes to make money from.
I want to play this one for you now. This is something that comes up a lot in this discussion. It's certainly come up on our end drive a couple of times. This is Lauren from Wagga Wagga.
Hi, I'm 29 and live in Wagga Wagga in regional New South Wales. As a young single woman, I bought a humble investment property with an $80,000 deposit that I mostly saved, earning $13 an hour while I was at uni. Later on, when my now husband and I moved to Wagga Wagga a few years ago, we added to that with a very affordable four-bedroom, two-bathroom house on 1,000 square metres in a really lovely, well-established but still modern area. While my parents gave me a comfortable upbringing, they certainly aren't rich and I've had no handouts. My first non-casual job was $45,000 a year, and I've managed to work up to about $70,000 a year. So from what I understand, below average. My husband just got a promotion to $85,000 a year, so certainly not high income earners as such. I certainly haven't stinged while I've worked. I've paid my own way through uni. I partied very, very hard. I have travelled all over the world at various times over the years. So my advice is maybe people should consider coming to live in Wagga Wagga.
Similar to the advice there.
Want for nothing in this wonderful city.
Similar advice there to Barnaby Joyce, where he came on RN Drive actually a couple of weeks ago and suggested people move to Tamworth if they wanted to find affordable housing. Is it true, Louis, that housing can be cheaper outside the cities, and is there merit to that argument that we need to perhaps create the policy settings, the jobs, make it possible for people to do this?
Absolutely, it's true that housing is far more affordable in the regional townships and outside the main capital cities. There may well be some sound reasons for that, of course. But nevertheless, that's an absolute fact, and it is one of our solutions that we've put forward, that perhaps we need to create additional incentives for people to consider living in regional townships. Certainly, if we want to grow our economy and our community over the long term, we certainly believe that the growth of regional townships is key to that.
Fleur, Barnaby Joyce was ridiculed when he made this suggestion, but he's actually stood by it despite that ridicule. While it might work on an individual level, does this advice help at a policy level?
He has taken policies to move government services to regional towns, including his own hometown of Armidale, to quite a bit of controversy. The problem is that while some people might want to move there, others do not, because in the case of the agricultural agency that he moved, people already had established lives in Canberra, where, you know, elderly relatives, kids at school and that sort of thing. So it's difficult, but it is all about the jobs in regional towns, and they have to be stable. They can't be wholly reliant on the mining boom, because we've seen what happens when that goes bust, in particular in North Queensland, where houses were incredibly expensive and now they've got broken windows and no one's living in them.
Nicole, from a planning perspective, how can we encourage people to move to regional areas? Because there are reasons that everyone's not joining Lauren in Wagga Wagga. There are reasons that people move to the big cities where there are very established infrastructure, established and dynamic work environments where people, you know, can leave a job and walk into another one, for instance.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, research shows, in fact, people have been moving the other way. Jobs have been moving the other way. And they're not just moving to the major population centres. They're moving to the heart of those population centres, and particularly Sydney and Melbourne. So we can't fix this problem overnight. But over the long term, absolutely, I think we need to look at a policy for sustainable decentralisation. That does mean reinvestment in regions. It means the types of infrastructure that creates long-term jobs, like universities, hospitals, a great transport network, for instance, and networked systems of regional areas as well. That won't happen by giving people cash grants to move to regional Australia. But it will happen by looking very carefully at where we're investing and whether we've got a long-term plan for the regions. I would like to say one thing, though. When you look at house prices relative to incomes in regional Australia, the housing affordability pressures facing people in rural communities, notwithstanding the wonderful story from the resident in Wagga Wagga, housing affordability and indeed homelessness is also a problem in regional Australia.
Louis, regional Australia is not immune from expensive housing either. A recent international survey comparing median incomes to house prices found Wingicarabee and Tweed Heads came in as the 7th and 8th least affordable housing markets in the world. This isn't just a problem in the cities, is it?
No, it's not just a problem in the cities. And I can bring up the case of Karratha back in 2011, where the median house price at one point hit $1.1 million. That's an example of a boom-bust cycle that do hit the regional townships quite hard. And the point certainly taken that one of the issues with regional townships is that they can have a very narrow economic base, which creates unemployment problems. So, look, going back to your question, yes, you can have regional townships which still can have affordability issues. But by and large, on our data, when we've looked at regional townships overall, we see certainly better affordability, but there's reasons for it.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis, and I've got three panellists discussing the big issue, the barbecue stopper of our generation, and that, of course, is housing affordability. Nicole Gurran, Louis Christopher and Fleur Anderson are my guests. Let's hear from Michael. He and his partner live in Canberra, both have pretty well-paying jobs. They're in their early 30s, looking at the property market, considering their options, but they say things are looking pretty grim.
We're better off under the current situation to buy a property as an investment property, get people into that property, negative gear that property, and then live somewhere else, which is absolutely mad that a better option for people, young people, is to invest in housing and not to buy housing to live in.
Louis, is he right?
I think he is in part right. I hear this often. And I know many young people are considering this, where they cannot afford to buy in the area they want to live. So instead, they will buy an investment property, perhaps in an area they don't want to live, rent that out, and rent in the area they actually want to live in. That happens quite often. I think it's happening more and more occasionally.
Fleur, negative gearing. It's the elephant in the room. The government, yes. Of course, it's a contested political territory throughout the whole election campaign, a big issue because Labor did commit to doing something and the government didn't. The government has ruled out changes to negative gearing, but could it move on this politically? As pressure mounts, I know there are some backbenchers, John Alexander, a good example of people who say, perhaps we need to look at this again.
Oh, look, it's devilishly difficult. You know, the last time someone moved on negative gearing, it was Paul Keating and Bernie Fraser, his Treasury Secretary at the time, said that they still don't speak to each other because it worked out so badly. There's talk about limiting the number of investment properties, possibly. I don't know how far advanced that is. And of course, the government considered for about 5 minutes doing something on capital gains tax, but then walked away from that very quickly after everyone threw their hands up in horror. So it's a really difficult thing. They need something that's a quick fix that can give a headline in the budget, but not be too harmful to the housing market that it annoys everybody. But they also need to have some sort of long-term plan. And these generally tend to be the less sexy plans, like the City Deals package, where it's encouraging local councils to create the type of the inner-city developments that are more livable and more affordable. But these things take 3 to 5 years, so it doesn't have the immediate bang for your buck. So, yes, it's a really difficult area for them. And so far, the most movement we've seen is on bond aggregation schemes, which is for community housing. And there's a bit of movement on that with Scott Morrison, but that doesn't seem to be the big headline thing that will be in the budget.
No, it's got to be something else, you'd think. Nicole, Michael, the man we just played sharing his story, goes on to say he and his partner are looking at investing in different ways instead of cracking the property market. If this is the shift that we're living through from a country of homeowners, potentially we're going to see that shift to a country of renters, do we need to rethink our approach to regulating the rental market? Because at the moment, it's not the most secure way to live for a lot of Australians.
I think that's right. I think there's two points we need to make. One is your listener is fortunate enough to be able to exercise choices in the housing market, even though they're not necessarily the ideal set of choices. But for low income, for much lower income renters, they've got very, very few choices and they're looking at a prospect of renting their whole life. Now, our rental system is designed to be a transitional tenure on the housing ladder towards home ownership and outright home ownership by the time you retire. So if that's not going to be achievable for people, we need to reconsider whether we're prepared as a society to have families doubling up, living with other families, facing very uncertain tenure, facing rising rents and the prospect of sudden eviction, or whether we want to have people living in a much stabler, secure renting environment and give them some decent housing options that are long-term.
So given all of that, Louis, according to the OECD, more than 93% of German respondents tell pollsters they're happy with their current housing situation, and less than 43% of them own their own house that they actually live in. Do we need to think about the way we think about owning houses? Is it perhaps, you know, we need a shift in our thinking to accept that perhaps isn't going to happen anymore?
I'm so glad you raised this point. Absolutely. I think we need to reconsider. Why is there a stigma attached to renting? It's to me, it's quite strange, because when you do look at Europe, first world countries, for example, in Switzerland, the home ownership rate is 50%. In comparison, here in Australia, we're running in basically the high 60s. Why is this stigma? Why is this dogma that we have to own our homes? That's something that I would like to put out there. I don't think we necessarily need to have that stigma. But at the same time, if we're going to be relying more on rentals, and yet I think we do need to tighten the rules up just a little there, where the rules, I would say, arguably favour landlords a little bit more than tenants. It's a good question. Obviously, it's got something to do with status, and I think we need to reconsider it.
Let's hear from Corey. She's a listener who's got into the housing market when she was living in London. She lived there for 10 years, became a resident, and this meant she had access to their affordable housing schemes. She bought a share of the apartment she was living in. To qualify, she had to live or work in the area and earn under a certain amount. Have a listen.
Basically, I started with a 35% share and so therefore had a mortgage for the value of that 35%, and then had to then rent that 65%, the value of that, and I needed to pay that each month to the Housing Association. So it was a scheme that was supported by the government and then the Housing Association, and then I had a mortgage as well for that 35% share.
She went on to sell her share in the apartment, and rising property prices in London meant her investment paid off because she could then put a deposit on a house in Australia. Nicole, should the government be looking at something similar to what she describes? Is there an Australian version of a rent-to-buy scheme that could work here?
Absolutely. And, there's certainly exist schemes in parts of Australia, South Australia, Western Australia, and the ACT have all experimented with schemes like this. One of the really striking things about the United Kingdom story is that they do have a more balanced housing system. And by that, I mean they've got a viable, affordable housing sector which is able to provide a whole lot of affordable housing options which tend to cross-subsidise each other. So at the top end, you're talking about affordable home purchase, similar to the model that was described. And at the bottom, you're talking about affordable, permanent or stable rental accommodation. And all of the policy levers, including the planning system, are geared towards making that a viable sector of the housing system. And that's what we need to move towards in Australia.
So I suppose if we move on to where this all kind of lands, where we move on this, I'd like you to answer this. I want you to pretend you're Scott Morrison or Michael Suka, who's his assistant minister, the guy who really assists in this area, is working on this with the Treasurer. What's one policy that should be in the budget on May 9th? I'll start with you, Louis.
Oh, one policy.
I know.
Okay.
Because, of course, it's a very interconnected system. But what do you think could really kind of
The problem with this is that there is no perfect policy when I look at it all. There's no clear-cut answer. It's such a complex issue. We've considered a number of policies. One of them, you could potentially cut immigration because that would, on a short-term basis, reduce demand right now in an overheated market. We could address the issue of the taxes and the transaction costs which are involved in building property, buying and selling property. So one of the strong views we have is that let's get rid of stamp duty and have a broad-based land tax. That would encourage mobility. It would encourage people who want to upgrade, downgrade, to sell up. At the moment, I'll take my example. I own a home in Sydney, would like to upgrade perhaps one day, too afraid to, because the transaction cost in doing that for me will be over $100,000. So I can't sell, really, because of that transaction cost. So if we can find a way to reduce transaction costs and also find a way to reduce the building costs. If you actually want to build a dwelling in this country now, the cost in doing that for a developer in terms of the taxes involved, the duties involved, are well over $100,000. So I think we need to address those particular issues.
If I can ask you, Fleur, I know you're a journalist. Your professional objective usually is to sit on that fence, but go there.
Oh, look, I think there's could be some really interesting things done on the ageing population and building more intergenerational housing. There's some really fantastic work that's done by the Institute of Australian Architects on intergenerational housing involving solar panels and Tesla batteries and really fantastic layouts that allow, two or more generations of a family to live in the same on the same block of land, but very, very separately. And I think some measures around that, encouraging parents or grandparents to share, and also, people to share with their parents, could have some really great societal effects.
I'll just give you the final word, Nicola. We're quickly running out of time, so if you could be brief.
Thanks. Look, we've been so piecemeal and half-assed about housing policy in Australia. We should be asking ourselves what we want is such an important sector of the economy, and we want stable housing production irrespective of the market cycle. So for my money, we need to rebalance the system and we need to be investing properly in the affordable and non-profit housing sector.
I want to thank the three of you. You've been wonderful guests and it's such a huge conversation. I think we've just scratched the surface there. Thank you so much for coming on. And thanks to also to all the people who sent voice memos. Your contributions were just so important in having a conversation, to actually hear what's happening, how you're interacting with this system, whether you've tried to buy a house, whether you've got a good idea. Thank you so much. Nicole Gurran is a professor in urban and regional planning at the University of Sydney. Fleur Anderson, a political journalist at the Australian Financial Review, who's written extensively about this. Louis Christopher, a property market analyst with SQM Research. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Karvelis on your radio till 7:30.